Hello and welcome back to this week's episode of the Rugby Paper Podcast. Plenty on the menu today is joining us to take trips down memory lane, discuss the Champions Cup, Northampton, England and the British Lions, is England World Cup winner and rugby legend Matt Dawson. We'll get going then. Welcome back to the Rugby Paper Podcast. Feels like it's been a while and we've had a little 10-day gap. In that time, the knockout stages of the Champions Cup have crystallised and are now well and truly set. It's quarterfinal weekend coming up. We'll preview that alongside talking a little bit about England and the British Lions. And joining myself and the columnist today, a few days after his beloved Northampton secured their quarterfinal spot, is World Cup winning scrum half and England legend Matt Dawson. Did you enjoy the weekend, Matt?
Yeah, I did. I shot 79, so I'm shaft to bits.
Well, where were you playing?
I'm very fortunate to be a member at Sunningdale, so it was a good score.
Lovely. Not very bad. Good. Tough course as well, so 79 is a good score.
It is. Well, it'd be a past 70, so but it is tough, yeah. But I'll take 9.
I didn't know there was a crazy golf course at Sunningdale.
Oh, see, now you've just ruined your invite.
You know, just as well, Matt, I'll tell you.
I have no idea. I know his idea of a golfer. Believe me.
Chewy, that's not just your golf invite, that's your invite to this podcast as well.
Oh, I see. Excellent. Well, nice to see you all.
So, well, I suppose we've just had a little insight into it, but Matt, talk about your life at the moment. From the outset, it seems very chaotic, but in a very good way.
That's it. Oh, right. Okay. I'm interested to know what the outset.
Sorry. Well, from the outside.
From the outside, how that looks. Not so much in rugby, other than I do a little bit of work around sort of behind the scenes stuff in some administrative roles, which is sort of consultative, which is great. Keeps my hand in a little bit, but mostly working in town, real job. Tim Rodbert is still one of my bosses. And spending time with the family, playing golf, and trying to keep the walls from the door, as ex-pros are all trying to do.
How long have you given yourself to have a healthier current account than Tim Rodbert, Matt?
I'm not sure that'll ever happen. as he's my boss, it's not supposed to happen, is it, Chris? But I've enjoyed it. I've really, really enjoyed it. I mean, you guys will remember Rodders for being a very confrontational, organized, military, no holds bar individual. And he hasn't really changed too much, but he's worked out how to temper it in the corporate world to be he's a significant operator. He really does know how to, bring people together, teams together, innovation, creativity. I mean, in a workspace world where it's very, very confrontational, dog eat dog, and it's not all about the presence of the individual that he brings. It's the knowledge and the manner and character of Tim has not changed, so he does get things done really well.
I remember going to the opening of his offices on Richmond Green, was it, about 1994? Yeah. And I thought then, he's either going to be a billionaire, mega success, or this will be closed down in 6 months. And it was obviously it was the former, because he's got some real good stride and quality, doesn't he, Tim? And, you could see how he was really into it. I thought, is he messing around with this, or is this just a sort of, he's fallen into it? But no, he had a plan from the word go.
Yeah, and he was always like that, wasn't he, as a player? And maybe to his detriment, he retired in 2000 and probably could have played. I don't know whether maybe he could have been in contention for the World Cup in 2003. But had a bit of a roller coaster relationship with Clive, got his teeth stuck into corporate world, and then was I could really make this work, and he's never looked back since. You know, he's absolutely dedicated, day in, day out. You know, he's built a business from, it's got to be 10 plus years that we've been there, and it started at about 60 people, and now it's at 600 people. You know, turnover from, I think it was, I don't know, 16 million quid to selling the business 2 years ago for, you know, a lot. Yeah. You know, it's of course, he's never going to say it's all him, but I think it's that, particularly in that space that we're in, his absolute dedication to success. I mean, we forget he was, you guys won't forget, but he was way ahead of his time. He was with, you know, going up against Dean Richards. He wasn't the old school type of player, was he? He was that very more a modern day back row, opposed to a Teague or Winterbottom or Robinson or, you know, Dean Richards. Him and Ben Clark were very much different types of back rows. So he's always sort of been pushing himself a little bit, and I quite like it, guys. I quite like still being in that environment, because you have that, you sort of still have that rugby team relationship where, you know, there's a look to one another. As yeah, often he will look at me and say, you know, he doesn't need to say anything, but a look to say, pull your finger out. You know, you need to change what you're doing here. As well as he'll call me up and say some great things, and you know, we really need you to do X, Y, and Z, and keep that going. And it's, you know, it's a really nice relationship that I've sort of cherished and been very fortunate to keep on working with him.
A couple of cameos that stick in my mind about Tim are one where he picked Cobus Visser up off the ground, tipped him upside down, and dropped him on his head.
Fair tackle.
Was permitted in those days.
No. I think it was the first test against South Africa. I think in could have been 92 or 94. I'm not quite sure. 94 maybe. And the other, and the other was when you were playing Eastern Province, and Tim was tipped as the future England captain until. I think it was Kel Tremaine's son, who was a Kiwi playing for Eastern Province, decided to slot him. And it all went completely belly up when Tim lost his military composure.
He won the fight, though.
Oh, he certainly did. He did.
I remember John Callard, who was playing. That was a very rough game. I mean, that was a horrible game. I only watched it on TV. But I was doing something with John Callard. I was back on the Bristol Evening Post in those days, and John was reasonably local to us. I was doing some stuff, and he said, well, that was very funny with Rob Burr, because he actually came off the bench and said to the referee, Christ, what have you got to do to get sent off around here? About 20 minutes later, we found out.
Yeah. 11 shots he got away. 11. He got 11 hammer blows away in, I don't know, 4 seconds or something. It was pretty impressive,
yeah.
So they know just how far to push him in the boardroom, I suspect.
Well, I think it's quite a nice calling card, though, Nick, isn't it? I mean, nowadays with all this technology, if you just walk into a room and say, with your introduction, maybe you just have a little 5-second clip of you pummeling the shit out of somebody.
Matt, just well,
he hasn't changed his shape as well, by the way. If you saw him,
is he still ripped?
He's still an absolute man mounted, but ripped. You know, looks so strong.
We're all like that, Matt, I think you'll find. And
you are, Chris.
He was immense on that 97 tour, that Lions tour.
That first test, he absolutely hammered him, didn't he? The first 20 minutes, that set the tone a bit.
It's not often you see the Springboks gun shy, but when he came into view, they were shipping the ball on pretty quickly. Let's put it that way.
That's what makes him. That's what makes him relevant to today's game, as Matt was saying earlier. That is it. I mean, the game has moved towards what Tim was doing. It hasn't moved away. He'd be a big, big hit now in
Oh God! Imagine him playing. Oh my God! He
in all
would be
senses of the
loving
word.
it.
He'd be a big hit now, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would. Yeah. Absolutely right. It's slotting. No problem.
Matt, just while we're taking a trip down memory lane, and the first thing you said when you logged on to the Zoom call was that it's like 20 years ago all over again. And I just want to ask if you have any memories with our wonderful of encounters with our wonderful columnists that you'd be w willing or able to share with us.
Well, I mean, the first thing that springs to mind, other than Brendan, who Brendan and I worked together for probably a few years, didn't we, doing the
Three,
column?
4 years doing the column, yeah.
But to be honest, most of the time, I would spend trying to avoid them, as they well know. I wouldn't say I was a go-to player for these guys, because I was a moody little prick who, I was a chippy individual who, when and particularly with the media, there was, media was very different. It was very different types of writing, a different medium. It wasn't particularly as interactive as maybe it is now, obviously, with social media and podcasts and the like. And I took a lot of offense to the personal nature of a lot of the writing back then, and rather than only by certain individuals. And so I decided, you know what, I was a bit like, no, if certain individuals are going to write that, then I'm done. Which was, it was an immature thing to do, but you're in the bubble of playing international rugby, and you're going to have some regrets in your life, and I had to sort of just put up with that. But
You also had an
I think
ideal
that's
foil.
reasonable, though,
You
Matt.
also had an ideal foil, didn't you, Matt, in Austin Healey, who was prepared to jump into the limelight at any possible opportunity.
He wasn't scared of it, was he? He wasn't. He wasn't worried about anything that he was doing. He was going to create some kind of entertainment for the players, the management, the media, and he was very, very good fun to hang around with. I mean, and not that he is obviously on this call, but in that 01 where I was doing, I think I was doing it with Mick, wasn't it?
Mick was on the tour, wasn't he? So he did the
Yeah,
column.
I think I was doing a column with Mick then, and I wrote I was doing a diary, and the Telegraph did a headline basically saying that the coach doesn't inspire me, which is not what I said, but obviously that's the headline. You've got to go with it. And I've just done my my sent my column in, and Austin has walked back into the room. I'm sharing the room with him, and he's walked back from the press conference, which I didn't go to, and he just looked at me and went, "You are in so much trouble." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Have you not heard from home?" I'm like, "No, I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "Oh, your column has absolutely ripped it apart." And this is before the game. This is the morning of the game or something like that. As it pans out, Donald Lenihan went absolutely bonkers because I'd written some truths about the tour in the diary, or had insinuated things into the diary. Needless to say, I was on the bench, but needless to say, I didn't get on. And then I got fined. What really peed me off about that is, you guys know what we used to get paid, and it wasn't a lot of money, was it? at the time it was a few hundred quid or whatever it was, and I Donald Lenehan pulled me aside on the Monday after I'd apologized to the squad. The boys were ripping into me and laughing. I had to sit in front of the whole squad and apologize. We'd won the game, and but it was out of order to break ranks, even though all the players were they walked out of the meeting and were like, "Dorse, you're so right." I mean, that's exactly how we feel, all that sort of stuff. But what got to training on the Monday, and Donald Lenehan pulled me aside and said, "We've met, management have met, and we're not going to send you home." And then I was like, "Well, all right, thanks." He said, "But we're going to fine you." I was like, "Okay." He goes, "I think it's only fair that we should fine you what you got paid for the column." I was like, "Okay, fair enough. Whatever, let's move on." 5 grand I got fined for that.
You didn't get 5 grand for the column.
5 grand. And that was a third. I think that was a third of the fee of the tour
Yeah.
for that one column from Donald Lenehan. Leaders say I never spoke to him again.
I've got to tell you, by the way, Dawson, so I added it up. I think I did about 90 different sports when I've ghosted the columns. And just blowing a bit of smoke up your ass, you were by far the most punctual. You're always on the end of the phone when you said you were going to be there, except one occasion, 2003 summer tour. You'd done Maoris, New Zealand, Australia, and you all went on the piss in Perth on the way
Yeah.
back. Do you remember you were checking out the facilities for
Yes.
the
Yeah.
World Cup?
Come back.
And
Yeah.
I was chasing you down for about 2 days, and eventually I got you by the pool, I think, on the mobile, but you were absolutely hammered. So you sort of grunted a bit, and we put 1,000 words of grunts together. And we got the column. We had the best ever feedback on the column. You were sort of painting the picture of the good life, sitting by the swimming pool, end of season, beating the Aussies, beating the Kiwis, World Cup, here we come. And it got a really good
Sorry,
response.
who was painting that picture, Bren?
Well,
Was it
exactly.
you or
I was
was
painting it from a few
it
grunts and laughs
you?
and
Yeah,
just.
I mean, I'd love to claim that I remember those amazing words that column, but.
Well, at least you had it sort of the right way around, because when the late Eddie Butler did his equally famous 2001 column with Austin Healey, one of them had been drinking as well, and it wasn't Austin.
No, that was a good, that was a great column, that as well.
Oh, it was a belting column.
God, it was really, really good, wasn't it?
All
I remember
the best poetry is
the
written when you're as high as a
flag
kite. All the best poetry comes when you've been on something.
Matt, you mentioned how you weren't particularly compatible with the way the media operated back during your playing career. And obviously now doing what you do, you can kind of pick and choose, I suppose, your media battles, so to call them. But and players have the power to do that more a little bit as well. Do you think you'd be more at home with it and more comfortable with the sort of system now if you're a player?
I would like to think that I, nowadays that they have, the players have a better education as to how they can converse and potentially leverage the media better. I mean,
Yeah.
back when I was doing it, I say I was, in so many ways, I was really, really immature, and just in my thinking, and it didn't, like someone like, let's use Lawrence, great example of just was like, right, I can manipulate them, and I, Clive, I can manipulate the media here. And it doesn't take much, whether it's being available at the right time, for comments, whether it's taking them out for a beer or a bite to eat, or just being there and saying the right thing. There were lots of ways where it would just, it was very obvious who the media liked that than opposed to didn't have a relationship with. The media didn't dislike people, but they would have, a fair few favorites that they know that they could go to. And let's, whether it's the same now, I doubt it, but there were also some amazing moles that were, feeding this lot incredible stories. And so for some, not certainly not me, I didn't have that sort of foresight. I took it, as I said to you before, I took it all too personally. I just saw it as black and white print. Why are you saying that about me? Right, you're off the list. Right, you know, and it was just all a bit, you know, I just didn't get it. I really, really didn't get it. Whereas nowadays, I would like to think that with a bit of education from either the clubs or more senior players, and the relationships that you can build with the media, whether it be, you know, written, online, TV, radio, etc. I think you can sort of maximize each other's exposure so much better. I mean, a lot of the either writers or general journalists now are expanding their sort of their breadth of, dare I say, celebrity.
Yeah.
Because they're understanding how they can help the players and how the players can help them. And it wasn't necessarily as easy to do back then. It was these guys had a column to write, had a job to do. Now and again, they might get a chance to write a book with one of the players when they're retiring. But I can't imagine it was anywhere near as opportunistic as maybe it is now.
So did you feel
had Twitter on the 97 Lions trip, that would have been an event.
Thank God.
That was a narrow miss.
On that tour, though, Matt, I mean, we're of a certain age. I mean, us three, not like you two young guns. But we look back on that 97 tour, pretty much is the last of the first of the professional tours and the last of the amateur tours, if you see what I mean. It was actually quite convivial and inclusive in the relationships between the press and the players. Yes, there was some. There were always going to be players who just didn't like the media spotlight. They didn't really want to sit down and be interrogated or ask a load of daft questions. We were in the same hotels and we were having a few beers together and all that kind of thing. It was the most relaxed tour I ever went on, to be honest. That was a really, it's a golden memory, that tour.
Yeah, yeah. There's
what we're talking about at the moment.
The management must have been a large part to do with that, guys. Surely.
Geach was brilliant. Telfer was brilliant. Jim Robson was brilliant.
Fran was brilliant.
Fran got it. Yeah, it was. But also, it was excellent. And there were also just a bunch of massive drinkers in the squad.
Yeah. Also, Chewy, it was a winning tour, and that makes a hell of a difference too. Interesting, Matt, because I sort of think that, I mean, there are a lot of the the rugby journalists now. I think that their access to players, funnily enough, is in many ways it's a real bone of contention. It's been pretty poor during this sort of social media age, if you like, and there's been a lot of firewalling of players, perhaps more than there ever was. And I'm not sure that rugby union yet has got its head around the fact that in a very competitive sporting world, actually your accessibility is, and the leverage that you talk about, is absolutely critical to the promotion of the sport. And I think that a lot of players still haven't got their heads around that.
It's a really good point, Nick. It's a really good point. I think there's probably similarities in that there are some players out there that get it and will do the extra mile and do stuff away from the club and will maybe them and their agents will be clever about it.
Yeah.
But the contrast to the Lions conversation of, you know, Fran and Geach and Jim, Exeter. And who was our who was what was the name of the
Bob
media?
Burrows.
Bob.
Bob Burrows. Yeah,
Yeah.
the
That's right. Yeah.
ITV guy.
Compare with their sort of embracing it and saying, listen, we need this educators. I mean, we had what's his name from the who was the God, my memory's so bad, isn't it? One of your pals from the Sun or the Mirror
Oh, that
came,
was David Norrie.
Norrie, who actually pressed the squad about, stings and all the rest of it, and gave us a full briefing on what to look out for before we even get to South Africa. So the coaches and the management were absolutely on board and wanted to help us. Whereas now, as sort of you refer you allude to there, Nick, it's the coaches that are saying, no, don't go on this. I don't want doing that. I mean, even to the point where I've and other ex-pros have been banned from going to training with sort of corporate sponsors and because as if we're going to dish the dirt or, I mean, it's bonkers. It's utterly bonkers. But that's being stopped by the coaches. And we do have to be a little bit careful that if we all know how much the game is struggling. The game needs to, I mean, it's not even, I can't believe it will be in the top 10 sports in the world for popularity. There'll be cricket, basketball, football, volleyball will be in the top five.
Tennis, golf. Well, tennis certainly. Golf, maybe
Yeah,
not as much.
golf is miles down, and so is rugby. If we're going to take this game forward, we've got to have, as you mentioned, Nick, that the communications behind it, and rather than I've spoken to. I'm having a conversation with sort of one of your colleagues about the sort of disgruntled relationship that some of the journalists have with a lot of the clubs because they just can't get either they can't get access or the clubs have not really got a comms, a quality comms team to deal with it, and they're being blocked by the coaches. I mean, it's
It's
if you
not a
go from one
priority.
extreme, you go from one extreme to the other, don't you? Where you're like, what you've got rugby, who really should be pushing to market and tell the world about how great a sport is. Sometimes we're shooting ourselves in the foot and strangling ourselves with all the negativity around rugby, but we're also not prepared to give new people access, or even existing fans, access to the sport. As you look at Formula One, where you will all know, as I will all constantly meet whenever someone mentions Formula One. Nowadays, I mean, it's my other half the other day. Oh, can we watch Drive to Survive? I'm like, what? So like, oh yeah, I don't really like Formula One, but Drive to Survive was amazing. I saw the first two episodes on Netflix. I want to watch it. And they've got access, as so much access to the players, whereas, we're still behind the eight ball, really.
So were
And show
you
you how much it's changed, Matt. Before that 97 Lions trip, which was my first Lions trip, Barry Newcombe, the late Barry Newcombe, wrote out a little 10-point memo to me about what to do on Lions trips as a journo. And number one was always attend the training in the morning, because he said the manager, the coach, and the players will notice if you don't. If you're off late night or got other things, sightseeing, having a lay in, it will be noticed. You are so expected to be at every training session. It was almost like you'd be fine if you weren't at the training session.
really?
And now you can't get in for love or money.
No.
Do you
No.
remember Graham Henry before the last test in 2001, last Lions test? He'd fallen out big time with the press. He wasn't a very happy man. And the eve of test, what would now be called the captain's run, he barred the press from it completely. And then they held it at Manly Oval, which is a public space. So along with the thousand people from Manly who turned up to see the Lions practice their lineouts were the entire press corps who he couldn't actually stop from entering. It's just an example of how the coaches overthink stuff and react very negatively when they feel that the press is getting on their back a little bit or if there's some danger from the press, and they make a dumb call like that. It just made him look ridiculous. And he's a bright bloke.
That was the same session, Chris. The same scenario where we caught one of the people watching training with their coat like this, and they had a video camera. Yeah, and bearing in mind this is 97, it wasn't a small thing. And it was like sort of strapped around his chest, but he was holding there just videoing all the line outs.
So what did you say to Eddie, Matt?
Yeah. It was just madness. Utter madness.
Just while we're semi on the subject of Lions, because I don't want to get through an entire episode without talking about anything on my list. Matt, I want to run our British and Irish Lions 15 by you. We put it together the week after the Six Nations. Don't feel obliged to give us yours. If you have it locked and loaded, by all means do. But I'll go through ours slowly and you can unpick it if you want to, if that's okay with you.
Go on there.
We've got an all-Irish front row, Andrew Porter, Dan Sheehan, Tadhg Furlong.
Yeah, okay.
If there's nothing screaming out, I'll move on. Maro Itoje and Joe McCarthy in the row.
I mean, weirdly, the one that I would maybe question would be Maro Itoje.
Which we didn't feel, to be fair, just because in a Lions shirt, he has always been a bit of a... So we're hoping that he would bring the best out of himself. Tadhg Byrne...
If you were going to replace him,
yeah,
I think someone like this George Martin is going to be a big Lion. I just think he's got that... Like the McCarthy, he's got something about him, something really horrible about him that other teams are going to not want to come up against.
I think we maybe said that if it was South Africa, I think a Martin McCarthy second row
would
be hard hitting. But for that reason, we've gone a second row at six in Tadhg Byrne, Ben Earl and Caelan Doris as a back row.
Decent.
Jameson.
Who's at seven? Earl.
Earl's at seven, Doris at eight, which we toed and froed about. But yeah, to fit them both in, we did that. Doris is our captain. Jameson Gibson-Park at nine, which I think is almost impossible to disagree with at this point. Finn Russell at 10. Bundy Aki and Ollie Lawrence in the midfield. James Lowe, Doohan Van der Merwe, Hugo Keenan as the back three. If there's anything screaming out to you, then...
What did you say the back three was there? Keenan, Van der Merwe,
and James Lowe.
Yeah.
The only other name we were semi-discussing was actually Emmanuel Bayiwoboso.
I think it's probably a bit early for him.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Another Six Nations, some autumn internationals, but with that, the quality that you've just mentioned there at that level, bloody hell.
Yeah.
When you got turfed in that 97 Lions series, Matt, I mean, you weren't the oldest yourself. I mean, you've been around a bit longer than he had. But was there a tangible difference in how you regarded the responsibility of the shirt when you were given a Lions starting place? I mean, that's a good old step, isn't it, for a youngish player?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to put the context in of how it all came about, though. I mean,
Rob Howley was injured, wasn't he?
And the battle was about the bench.
Yeah, you and know, Austin was the only other choice, so you were bound to win that.
I mean, I was always going to win that, wasn't I?
I'll tell you what, Matt, he tried to head it off. He came into the press conference just before the team was announced. and regaled us all and said, you know, they're talking about Matt Dawson. They can't pick him. It's got to be me.
Oh, you ask him about it.
We all knew from the off, from Weybridge, that it was going to be Rob and Gregor. Everybody knew it. We'd had, I don't know, 7 weeks of basically who's going to get on the bench. And I was well aware that Austin, Paul Grayson spoke to me a lot about this whilst he was on the trip, before he went home on, you know, I had to bring something else other than scrum half, because Austin was always going to be able to cover lots of positions. It didn't really matter who was playing well enough at scrum half. It was, well, what are you going to cover? So Grace knew that I kicked goals and had spoken to Dave Allred to say, you should get Matt into the kicking group, because he'll be an option. And that's really where I started my sort of international kicking duties and reputation for being a backup kicker, was on the 97 Lions tour. I suppose from the games that we had, there wasn't an awful lot in it. It was purely down to, you know, what combination did they want to have on the bench and to complement what they were doing on the field in the back line regarding the kicking.
So you had two goal kickers and the Springboks had none.
Yeah. So if you, you know, that combination of, you know, Gregor wasn't a very good goal kicker. They picked Jenks at 15 because he was a goal kicker.
Yeah.
They didn't really have a lot of goal kickers. Stimmo was kicking, but was never going to be in the squad because of the other players that were around. So they absolutely needed another goal kicker. And then, as it pans out, I end up being on the bench for the Natal game when Rob gets injured. Then I played my best half of rugby, you know, a week before the test match with all the other test match players for Geach to say, and obviously Geach had seen me at Northampton, but then all of a sudden Jim and Jono are watching me at that level and thinking, actually, he's slotted in really well.
Yeah. And then the try in the first test put you on an absolute upward trajectory, didn't it? Austin couldn't get at you after that.
Well, no, that would have been, I think that would have been a brave call to drop me after that game.
Gary Teichman's still looking for you, by the way.
Yeah.
Send his regards.
Bless him. Him and the five others.
Yeah.
the best moment of that trip, rugby wise, most memorable rather than best, probably one of my most memorable moments would have been in the third test when Austin Healy came on and was told by Geach and Jim to come on for Jenks at fullback. And Austin Healy went up to the fourth official and said, right, okay, they want me to go on. And the fourth official said, who are you going on for? And he said, Matt Dawson, number 9. And he did not give a shit about what the coaches said. They dragged me off in the third test of the Lions. Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
Oh, brilliant.
I mean, could you even begin? I mean, obviously, it couldn't happen now, but the audacity of him is just remarkable.
Unbelievable. I mean, how many minutes, how long was there remaining?
Probably, I bet there's 20 minutes to go. Yeah. It must have been. I mean, I did wonder, because I'd, I was playing really well, scored a try, was organising. You know, we were on the sort of comeback a little bit because we were behind. And then it was like, all right, okay. Fair, yeah, fair.
That's fantastic.
Oh, good.
Matt, I'm conscious that we don't keep you too long, but I do want to talk about England a little bit. And obviously the Six Nations were a few weeks ago now, so we won't talk about it too in depth, but you compared this England side to that of 2007 and 2015 before the World Cup in terms of coming in potentially a little bit under fire, and it could go one of two ways. And it was a pretty successful World Cup, but how do you compare the rebuild to that of post 2007, which maybe wasn't quite so successful, and 2015, which was obviously very successful?
15, unsuccessful. Or no, the rebuild.
The rebuild afterwards, yeah.
I think... Yeah, we came third, didn't we, in the World Cup, which, you know, is, we say remarkable because we have the brutal honesty around that tournament was that if England had not got to a semi-final, it would have been a monumental balls up. And, you know, we can't get away from that fact that they were never going to fall at the hurdle of being in the group, of not being getting out of the group. I mean, just there was not a chance they were going to lose. It doesn't matter how bad, but just because they lost against Fiji, it didn't matter how bad they were going to be. They were always going to get out of the group to either play, you know, Wales or Fiji. And given the quality, which we're seeing now, which is really the main point I will make, given the quality that England have, I think it would have been a proper disaster if they hadn't got into that semi-final. England played and have been playing the most tedious style of rugby over the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, maybe, to a point where people were not falling out of love with the game, but just would be a little bit, well, is this what we're going to go and watch? Is this, look at everybody else, what's everybody else doing? It was just so dull. And I do genuinely think that Jamie George has been the catalyst in all of this. Mm. And I know that has to then connect with the fact that Owen Farrell isn't in the squad and has moved on. But I really do think that Jamie George has been instrumental, because there's not a chance that Steve Borthwick has all of a sudden said, oh, right, okay, we're going to change what we've been doing for the last year and a bit, and this is how we're going to play, because that's not Steve Borthwick. You all know Steve Borthwick, all right? We all know what he's like. We all know what he's good at and has been good at for his whole entire life. He's not all of a sudden going to turn around and suggest that England play like they have in the latter parts of this Six Nations. And if I was putting my player hat on, I think just some of those senior players led by Jamie have probably had a little moment and thought, I can't go through the next cycle playing like this. I don't want to. I'm not, you know, I've got 70, 80, 100 caps. I'm just not, I'm going to look back on my career and have a number of caps. So what? What, a load of caps where you lose or you don't pick up trophies? I mean, who cares? That's just such a selfish viewpoint. Opposed to, I think someone like Jamie gets it, that you could have 20 caps, you could have 40, 50 caps. If you got a World Cup trophy, you can do what the hell you want for the rest of your life. Yeah, as 31 of us have proven from 2003. You know, there are I don't know who had the most caps out of that group, probably Jason, obviously, but you know, lots of people on 40, 50, 60 caps in that group. And yet there's this race to get loads of test matches under your belt, but no one's really going to care.
No,
I mean, genuinely, in another 20 years, no one cares how many caps you've got. They really don't. But they do care that you're the world's best team. And I think something's triggered in Jamie to say, this is not going to happen in the way that we're playing. We have been playing. Let's look at the talent that we've always had and let's use it. And I just don't think that Steve would have any answer to four or five of his top players saying, you know, some things have got to change.
No, that's interesting. That's interesting. And how important, Matt, and I'm thinking of Northampton as much as England now. I mean, Northampton are playing, a wildly entertaining, stroke exhilarating brand of rugby. I mean, if you were local to Franklin's Gardens, why wouldn't you go and want to watch the stuff they're playing? How much does that go back to Chris Boyd? And if it does go back to Boyd, what did he do to accelerate this embrace of an all court attacking game that Northampton are bringing to the field now?
Yeah, I'm sure it has, Chris. Gone back to Boydie. I think he brought that sort of Wayne Smith feel to the club, and that's to the fans and to the club of, you know, 'cause Northampton's always been that type of place where they've had all the facilities and all the money and all the sponsors and the best pitches and yada, yada, yada. It's been comfortable. And it was always a battle. Even, you know, when I was there, it was always a battle because it was too comfortable. And I think people like Wayne Smith, people like Chris Boyd have a talent for making it comfortably uncomfortable.
Mm.
And the environment that they started to create was a, you know, they were, you could see that they were really grasping hold of the responsibility and being accountable for the town and the people and the club. They were lacking a little bit up front, weren't they? They were lacking that little bit of firepower, but they had a confidence and an ethos that was, you know, sort of maybe the envy of a lot of clubs, actually, in the way they were playing. And when I watch Northampton, very rarely do I feel it's risky. Most of the time, I feel it's really good decision making. And and top level sport, doesn't matter whether it's snooker, rugby, formula, what, it really doesn't matter. The top teams or the top players make it look really very simple, very effective, very fluid. It doesn't look rushed. It doesn't look like you're taking risks or there's those 50-50 balls. Everyone looks in sync. And now Northampton have got a bit of ballast everywhere amongst the squad. You know, whether they've got enough to go up against your Toulouse or Bordeaux, I'm sure we'll find out in the next few weeks. But or indeed the balls at the weekend, but I think it stems from that foundation that Chris Boyd and that coaching side with Vesti was involved in that as well, wasn't he? But was Dowse there when Boydie was there?
His assistant, wasn't he, for a good while?
Yeah.
I mean, when you watch Saints, you see a team. The passing is just perfectly honed now, isn't it? There's a massive difference between Northampton and even other Premiership sides in their ease on the ball. If I can't remember a Saints guy dropping a ball, and also they make difficult passes look easy, like you were saying, Dawes. everything looked absolutely drilled in. And when that's your basis, when you start from there, you can start doing really good things when you've got the athletes they've got as well.
Yeah.
The gas
yeah,
they've got.
I think that's part of the that's part of that sort of accountability piece. That Northampton, the coaches have ingrained into the players that, yeah, it might well be a really simple pass. It may be a really simple move, but it's got to be executed well.
Yeah, love it and treasure it.
That try that they scored at the weekend against Munster, when Freeman went through, everybody knows that Northampton do that move. Everybody. And if everyone tries to do that move, but everyone knows that those Northampton personnel do that move. You know, there's no surprises there. And yet it's executed at pace, so accurate that the defenders just simply cannot mark it. And that's very, very difficult to do because you've got to have the timing, the accuracy, you know, the buy-in, the commitment to it all, and they're doing it time after time after time.
What is it, Matt, with Northampton and scrum halves? I mean, it's a hell of a tradition now. I mean, there was you, then there was Dickie Jeeps. Sorry, no, there was Dickie Jeeps, then there was you. but I mean, you've had Lee Dixon. I know Cobus Reinach came from elsewhere. Mitchell is, you know, pretty much undisputed number one at the moment in the England sense. You've got a kid like McParnon coming through who looks as though he's got all the Dawson-esque qualities of annoying the hell out of opponents just with a glance or a couple of well-chosen words. It's a fantastic tradition, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what? They've got a little sort of little factory run, haven't they, over the years of players being... I mean... The Mitch is very, I think he's very different to the list that you've gone through there.
He's an outlier a bit, isn't he? In style,
yeah. I think he has a bit of everything. You know, someone like Copas, I mean, just blistering and proper show stopping moments. You know, I wouldn't have him down as running the game in the last, as proved in the World Cup final, you know, running the game under all of that pressure. He didn't necessarily have the game management and understanding. I don't think Lee Dixon did either. You know, skills and intricacies and communication for someone like Dicko, brilliant. But Mitch just has this. I think he just has a real instinct for the game that it is a slightly different level than any other scrum half, certainly in England at the moment, and probably should have been playing for England maybe a year or two earlier as well.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, but Eddie didn't really see it, which is, you know, unfortunately. To the detriment
and indeed, Steve Borthwick didn't see it until last summer because he wasn't in the World Cup squad, was he, initially?
Well, you know as well as I, Brendan, that, you know, Eddie and Steve would have been communicating a lot previously and known each other, and they're going to say the same things about the same players, Ben Earl, Alex Mitchell, you know, and fair play. Steve has, you know, has changed the tune, and that's a great skill to have and not be stubborn about it. But Mitch is, if it's a bit easy, it's too easy to say that he's a threat, because you could say Danny Kerr is a threat, but Mitch, Mitch is a as from a defensive point of view, he makes his team a threat. Now he might be part of that himself. You know, it might be running around the corner and dropping someone in, or it might be a tactical kick or speed of pass, or, you know, where his decision making around the breakdown is always very threatening. So of course, you know, the back row have got to stay down. The fly half can't drift away too much. It sort of all starts instinctively with, if you're in defense, like, what's Mitch doing? Oh, okay, he's passed it and you're gone. Whereas most other scrum halves that England have had, it's been, yeah, it's going to go to 10, it's going to 10, it's going to 10. Oh, it's going to a runner, it's going to a runner. And if you lose, it's a little bit like Peter Stringer. Really nice player, but you just knew, you pretty much knew it was relatively easy to read. And I think Ben Youngs has probably, unfortunately, turned into that type of player. Danny Kerr, you know, have their moments, but really, you sort of know what they're about.
What's interesting is also having a bloke like Tom James there as well, because, you know, I mean, he's a great foil for Mitchell in many ways, isn't he? You know, I mean, a bigger man and a more physical man, but very, very quick as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes playing against Northampton very difficult.
I think that they've got a very difficult game coming up, because I looked at the game. I actually had a look at it this morning, and you know, before Hendy, those two Hendy tries in the second half. I mean, the second one of which he didn't have any right to score at all. I mean, it was brilliant. He beat Crowley and
Zeebo, wasn't it?
Yeah, Zeebo as well, to score that. But I think that the Bulls, with Jake White as coach and the size of their win, I know it was at home on the, you know, at altitude in Pretoria, but, you know, almost putting 60 points past Lyon. And they are a very dangerous side, I think. And they've proved as well in the URC, they've gone away and won in big games. So I think that that's going to be, I think everybody is riding the crest of a wave after that that win over Munster. But I think that they're going to have a difficult game.
Yeah. I can't dispute that the Bulls are a good side. There's no question about that. I know the Bulls have won at the URC. I'm not sure they've beaten a team like Northampton. On their home patch.
No, but I sort of think Northampton are going to have to play even better than they did against Munster.
And Lyon were not good though, were they?
No. They were.
They left a few at home as well, in fairness. And yeah, it's a long way to go for a game of rugby. I mean, I know the Bulls are doing that in reverse, but it's...
And that's tough, Chris. I know you boys could easily travel down to South Africa and be prepped up for the next day, but it's slightly different when you've got to run around for 80 minutes. And
indeed.
Don't underestimate what we do, Matt. I mean, we're under real pressure. I'm talking of underestimation as a scrum half of your class, Matt. Are the things said about Dupont over the top, or is he as good as commonly described?
Someone said to me a couple of months ago. And admittedly, he was my age. But he said, if Dupont was playing in my era, would he be ahead of everyone? And if so, how far ahead would he be of Rob Howley, George Gregan,
Yeah.
Justin Marshall? Because I think that's a really fair question, because I think Dupont plays a style of rugby that probably was more frequently played 15, 20 years ago. I think the difference is with Dupont, though, is that not only has he got that vision and endeavour to do all of, you know, to hit the short sides, link, etc. But he's got the pace, he's got the power, he's got that. You know, Austin was a bit like that. Oh, so strong and so fast and so skillful. but Austin, you know, wouldn't necessarily have had the management skills in a big game to get the team through, whereas DuPont does. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Just would have had the individual brilliance to make the try-saving tackles, or, you know, make the break and finish off one-on-one with a fullback, but wouldn't necessarily have the finesse to bring in the big players around him and again manage the big games in attack, whereas DuPont does. You know, I'm struggling for anyone to ever say to me, yeah, but oh look, he's just been found out in this area of the game. I just don't see it. I really don't see it.
Yeah. Matt, so, he's played 250 senior games or something, started 250 senior games. And I think last year he got to a point where he played the same number of minutes as Johnny Sexton had played, and Sexton was 12 years older than him. And he's packed a lot of rugby in. And like you say, he's never had a bad game. I've never seen him have a bad game. He's always 8 out of 10. More often than not, he's 9 out of 10. And fairly frequently, he's a 9.5 and a 10. And I don't think anybody has matched that consistency ever.
No. I absolutely agree. It's I think it's a mixture of the slight old school mentality that he has of manipulating the opposition, being one step ahead of where they're defending, what the referee is up to. You know, again, that sort of snooker mentality of it's not about potting this red, it's where's the fifth red down the line? That's the one. That's my difficult one. So he's, and a vast majority of scrum halves in the modern day are, it's all about the here and now. It's about the ruck in front of you. Whereas not only do I feel DuPont has this sort of vision of the game, but he has the physicality to be able to do it. And, you know, so his training methods, his fitness, his ability to repeat it week after week when the opposition are looking out for you, and to create gaps and to make big tackles, to read the game well, to kick goals, to all of a sudden then be moved into tech. You know, he knows the game inside out. He's like he's Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, you know what I mean, where everything's just happening so slowly around him that he's like, yeah, no, I've got it. I've got everything under control here.
There's also the French dimension, isn't there? We the thing that separates a lot of French scrum halves stylistically from how the game is played elsewhere in the world. I mean, we go back to Frew and Bebizier and Gallion. I mean, there is so much of French rugby is on the shoulders of the nine in terms of immediate game management. You know, they don't have as many famous tens in history as a lot of other nations. They're great halfbacks. The most celebrated halfbacks tend to be nines.
That's true, and they've struggled, haven't they? Let's face it. Even your sort of Para and Yashvili that would be swapping over and changing positions. You're great, really, really good players.
Yeah.
But no one's really getting close. No one's getting close to, I was going to say where he could go, but he's already there. I mean, I don't know how many years he's been playing, but it feels like he's only been on the circuit 3 years. It's like, oh, he's one of these new players that can do everything. Oh, yeah. Keep an eye on him. We'll see. But, you know, he's been doing it for 5-6 years, I guess. I mean, it's just...
Well... More than that, because he's playing for Castor as a 17-year-old, so he's probably been doing it.
Mauro Bergamasco could have made it if he'd stuck at it.
Yeah.
Matt, I know. Well, how are you doing for time, Matt? Have you got 5 more minutes, or do you need to get right?
Yeah, we're all fine.
All right, oh, fantastic. Well, one other player I wanted to ask you about was Finn Smith, who is obviously increasingly staking his claim for that England number 10 show. He's already outplayed Jack Crowley once earlier this year, and he did the same, arguably, at the weekend. He's done the same with Owen Farrell a couple of weeks ago as well. What do you make of the sort of the Smith versus Smith vie for the number 10 shirt that's almost inevitable once Ford has hung up his boots?
Yeah, it's going to be a good tussle, and one that hopefully will last a few years. I think the one key difference for me, which will be in Finn's favour, and they are very different as fly halves, but the one key difference is I think if England want to win a World Cup, then they have to play Finn Smith. And for no other reason, and there is a lot of knowledge on this call, but you would struggle to name me a Maverick fly half who has won the World Cup. Yeah, and when I say Maverick, I mean, you know, a Finn Smith type, oh my God, look, he's doing it all himself type player.
Mm.
You would struggle to name me one.
Carter could have Maverick moments, but he was also incredibly consistent and solid and all that. Well, he was brilliant, wasn't he? He was just brilliant. But he could be he scored 29 tries. He was a miracle worker as well as a game controller. But he could do the game controlling brilliantly when he had to, couldn't he? He
didn't know. Butch James.
Possibly. but that's possibly the one. Maybe he's the outlier in. And the reason why I say that, and to answer your challenge and your fair challenge there, Brendan, is and rather than Maverick, name me a fly half who's won the World Cup where their heart rate has never gone other than the plateau of calmness, whether they're doing something brilliant or if they're in the shit. Yeah. Where the fluctuation of heart rate is minimal. And that is my real... It sounds ridiculous, and it's not really sort of quantifiable, is it? But that is...
It's the ice in the veins, Matt, isn't it? It's the ice in the veins.
And it worries me. It really worries me about Marcus because he's phenomenal. I mean, just does some unbelievable stuff. And... You know, I'm not saying he's a maverick like Carlos Spencer or, you know, someone like that or Danny Cipriani. I'm not talking about that. But there are moments, too many moments in games where Marcus is like adrenaline and heart rate goes absolutely through the roof, whether it's, you know, he scores a try or the team scores a try or there's a big moment and he's like whooping and hollering and blah, 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 blah.
No.
You're the general. What's next?
Yeah.
What's happening next with the team? Score the try, kick the conversion, move. You know what I mean? It's that.
I think that's a very good point, Matt. I think that's a really sound point. Yeah, he does get overexcitable at times, doesn't he? And does that sometimes that fuels him and he can do great things. But when you get to semi-finals and finals of World Cups, it might have the detrimental effect.
I mean, and to go back to your original question, Ollie, I see more of that with Finn.
I see
that analytical, sort of strategic fly half, and still has the capabilities to go through the processes and deliver it, but it's all very much in the delivery.
Yeah.
And it could be him individually or it could be the back line, but it seems to be, he seems to have that sort of flow of the game and then to be able to repeat and repeat. And we're, you know, I, the stuff in at Tom and Park in that awful weather, down to 14 men or whatever it was, you know, just they're the moments that I think, you know, you can do that there. You can, and I know, don't get me wrong, I know Marcus Smith has been fly off when Quins have had some big away games, all right? And I know that he has the capabilities, and that's why I think it's going to be a fantastic battle. But if you're asking me for a difference, that's potentially, that's quite a significant one for me.
A really interesting point, Matt. Overall, I see exactly where you're coming from with it. The only thing that intrigues me is the ability of players to grow. Some players don't seem to me to grow during their careers, and you know they're a shooting star, and it lasts for a while, and then they can't maintain it, or they fall off for one reason or another, injuries, etc., etc. Marcus Smith is a player who the question mark is whether he has the capacity to manage the game with that cool head that you're talking about, and that will require a change from him. There's no question. I can see that there's a bit more of that coming into his game. I don't know whether it I don't know how old he is. I think is he in his mid-20s now, I think?
I would say so, yeah.
I don't know whether at that stage it's possible to keep on growing and to build that more, or whether he's sort of, you know, his natural instincts are sort of so fixed that he won't be able to do that.
We've got to look at the coaching. We have to look at the coaches that are around him. I personally think it's doable, and the reason why
especially
I say that,
Nick Evans would be able, I assume is just the bloke to maximize Marcus's knowledge and his application of that knowledge, because Evans was, you know, for whatever he lacked as a 10, it wasn't rugby brain and instinct.
No, I mean, I think like I said, we don't know, don't we? We don't. I'd be fascinated to know what sort of the work, if they do work on that part of his game, because it. I think it would be really easy to see, because he scores lots of tries, and it's a really simple one for me. Is that you could, as a coach, you could easily say to Marcus Smith, right, the next time you score a try, I don't want you know, fist pumping to the crowd and, you know, getting hugged by all your mates or the rest of it. I want you to score the try, get back, kick the conversion and regroup and see if you have the mental capability. You know, I mean, we would all be able to see that, because it would be very obvious, because now when you see Marcus score, that's what he does. That's his celebration. And the reason why I'm convinced it is very coachable, I remember Sean Edwards talking to Owen Reddin. You remember the scrum half at Watson Island?
Yeah.
And he was, as I was in my, probably both my years at Wasps, he was my understudy for about half the year. And then it was like, no, this kid needs to come through here. And he was absolutely on fire, real live wire, head all over the place, but real live wire, loads of energy, read the game really well, but would be properly intense and sometimes would get a bit scatty. And Sean Edwards recognised it and then told him, right, before the game and at half time, you are not allowed to talk to the team. I only want you to go and warm up for a limited period of time. And then, as I say, at half time, you are going to sit in the change room and you're going to read a book. And he was like, what? I said, that's what you're going to do. And he did. I wouldn't be surprised if he did that for the rest of his career. But I remember, going in and, you know, before the game, there he is, just, you know, reading some random book, half time, would go in, read his book, and everyone's, you know, all right, do this, do that. What about this? Well, we've got to change this. But no, he was like, and then he would come in for the last couple of minutes, or you know, before the game, he would, right, he'd calmed himself down and go out for 20 minutes and all that. So all of that stuff can be done. It just depends on whether the coaches pick on the right sort of methods to be able just to make them realise where the benefits are.
By the end of his career, he was absolutely model pro, steady Eddie, wasn't he, by the end of his career, with a stack of Ireland caps. And he was the Mr. Dependable. None of the scattiness at all. It really did transform him.
Your argument's borne out, really, Matt, by what happened at last year's World Cup. I mean, the Springboks, for injury reasons as much as anything. But we all saw Pollard coming, didn't we? We all knew that at the very back end, when it really mattered, your Willemsers or your Libocks, when it came to who's going to get us through the biggest 80 minutes we're going to play, and they turned to the least theatrical, let's say, for want of a better word, of all the candidates to play 10.
Well, guys, you've been, goodness knows how many years you lot have been involved in rugby. You can't tell me at the very highest level, too much has changed, really. I mean, I know they're stronger and they're fitter and they're faster, but how they train, how they prepare, the mental side of the game, what wins games, what loses games, if you were to list them from, never mind 20 years ago when I played, it probably was the same in the 1990s, really. The fundamentals of how you win those big games are exactly the same.
It's what you call the abstractions of rugby, isn't it? The indefinables, they're not the things that shift. The measurables shift in terms of pace and power and dynamism and everything a GPS will tell you. But a GPS can't tell you anything about the abstractions of the game.
No. No, no, it can't. It can't tell you how momentum is. You could be going back on all the stats, you know, on the retreat, but you have momentum in the game because you've got the referee in the pocket, or you can see, you can hear what the opposition are saying and what they're talking about, and the panic you can feel from the opposition, or what they're worried about, or what little moves have worked for you that none of us can see from the touchline, or the hit in the scrum and who's struggling. Or you just can't see all of that at the highest of all levels. You just can't. It's so abstract, as you say, yeah.
If you had a GPS that could detect that stuff, Matt, Austin Healey would never have got on the field for you. He'd have had to go on for Neil Jenkins, because it would have had bullshit detector, wouldn't it?
If one of us had that, there is fuck all chance that we'd be on this podcast right now, I tell you that. We'd be in our estate somewhere with Rodders down in West Sussex. That's where we'd be.
Is that all of West Sussex?
Guys, I think we should probably look towards wrapping up. I just had one more thing on the menu today. Obviously, we've got four Champions Cup fixtures this weekend. We've got Bordeaux Harlequins, Leinster La Rochelle, Northampton Bulls, and Toulouse Exeter. Could I just get everyone's winners, please, starting with you, Matt?
Right, let's have a look here. But Bordeaux, as much as Harlequins can, they won in Racing, didn't they, in the group stages? But Bordeaux, very different proposition. I don't think they'll have enough over 80 minutes, Quinn, so I think Bordeaux will win that. Leinster, La Rochelle, blimey. So much history behind that. I just think it's probably going to go to a home win for Leinster. La Rochelle travelled away, didn't they, last weekend?
Yeah, they're flying back from South Africa, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough couple of weeks. So yeah, maybe just Leinster, Northampton. I actually think Northampton will be relatively comfortable. I don't mean a massive score, but I think they're in good shape to win that. And then I'm going for a fourth home win in Toulouse. I'd be very interested to hear if anyone else has got an away win, maybe La Rochelle, but.
I don't. I've got four home wins. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, I think home wins.
Yeah, same here with La Rochelle as the question mark, because they have got another dimension. Once that pack gets lumbering, they can make life very difficult. And they've got a tradition of coming back against Leinster, but I think Leinster are so up for this one. I think this is payback time, I think.
Yeah.
Chewing. I'm guessing the side
No, I'd love disagreeing with people, as you know. But I mean, look, Leinster La Rochelle is the tightest one. I do think the Bulls are dangerous, actually. I mean, that's a hell of a bat division if they're all playing. I mean, crikey! I mean, there's a lot of gas there, and that could be a wildly entertaining game. But I do take Northampton at their level of confidence in the kind of arena that the Bulls don't often play in, because those stadiums in South Africa are just gigantic, aren't they? I mean, Loftus. I mean, they might have had a decent crowd there at the weekend, for all I know, but you couldn't see any of them. I mean, because it's just such a huge stadium. Franklin's Gardens, which is one of my favourite grounds in the country, would just be that'll be a cracking atmosphere there, and it'll be very, very intense atmospherically, and it'll be a Northampton win, I think. So yeah, I go for four home wins. That was a long-winded way of saying four home wins.
It really was. I'm not sure the podcast was better for it, to be honest, but hey ho.
Yeah,
Brendan, have you got
really.
four home wins as well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Oh,
That's a
sorry.
very short way
Yeah,
of saying
sorry.
that.
Kano. Yeah. Kano, you've got four wins, four home wins.
I think that Northampton Bulls game is going to be a closer affair than Matt does, but I do think that Northampton, you've got to back them considering the way that they've been playing. But Jake White's a canny bugger.
I want to see Ronan O'Gara coaching with ice in his veins instead of in a huge frenzy of fire and having arguments right, left, and centre. I mean, it's a good place to have an argument, Matt, isn't it? Franklin's Gardens, up there in the coaches' boxes.
Why is Ronan O'Gara going to be having a scrap there?
He barely. Oh, so sorry, Frank. Cool. Yeah, that bit out.
No, that
Thank
bit's staying
you.
in, Chewie. Well done.
It's like it's 1 o'clock. Is it drinky
Just
time? Drinky time, please.
It was before the podcast started for Chewy.
Oh,
Yeah, so we've all got, well, that's 16 predictions for home wins. And if it is four home wins, that will mean 11 out of 12 home wins in the past 2 weekends. So that maybe reopens a door for a Champions Cup format discussion for later down the line.
whereabouts are the semi-finals? Do someone educate me with that?
Think that don't Northampton stay at home?
Unless
I sounded out
Leinster are
every
banged
game
to
to
stay
in
at home.
England somewhere.
I can have a look. Hang on.
Leinster are banged to stay at home because they always do.
They always do. It's written into the contract that they
Yeah,
play every
yeah.
match at home.
Oh, it also on the Champions Cup website, it all says TBC,
Right.
which
I think I heard that Milton Keynes is being lined up for the semi if Northampton win.
Leinster get a nosebleed if they leave Dublin. That one will
Well,
say. Oh,
maybe Ronan will be coaching Leinster by then anyway. So,
yeah.
along with the Bulls.
It'll be very different to Leo Cullen, won't it?
Oh, guys, I think let's wrap up there. We've got our predictions. We've gone off piece, but we've covered pretty much all I set out to cover. Matt, great having you. And are you playing golf this weekend?
Yes, it is the Masters medal this weekend
Awesome, mate.
where yeah, there's a medal on Saturday morning, and before you tee off, you will draw out someone in who has made the cut, and your score is aggregated with their score.
Oh my God.
So you could end up shooting your lights out and then get some proper dodgy player shooting 82 and lose. So yeah, good fun.
That's
What
really good.
What handicap do you play off, Matt?
I'm off six.
All right.
Who's your pick to win the Masters?
I feel, I mean, Scheffler's going to be hard to beat. What's his name? Oh, goodness me. Wacken Neiman's on good form. Hideki's also. Is it? No, Matsuyama.
Any chance of Rory sneaking in on the blind side now everybody's written off his chances?
I mean, I would love it. I'd love it for him to complete it, but I mean, all right, maybe he's under the radar now. Could you even begin to imagine that he's near the top of the leaderboard
on Sunday?
Go absolutely off.
Yeah.
And let's see whether he's Marcus Smith or Finn Smith.
Oh, good rap. Good rap.
Ooh. Well, you've done this before, Matt.
Matt, thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy that. What do you call it? Masters medal this weekend. I hope you get Bryson. I think Bryson's going to win it.
Yeah. Well, and it's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me on, Ollie. Lovely to see you, you fine gentlemen. I'm sure that we will see each other on the circuit at some stage.
And you, Matt. And thanks for making it from Barbados, Ollie. Well done.
Yeah, well done. You're joining us and interrupting your golf holiday.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Rugby Paper Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use and recommend the show to your friends. The Rugby Paper is available to buy every Sunday, and to make sure you don't miss it, subscribe through our print, digital and online options at therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions. That's therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions to get all our content for as little as 14p per day.